Welcome to TechNet Radio, your guide to the IT universe.
Hi, and welcome back to TechNet Radio. This is our show for Tuesday, January 30th, 2007. I'm Aurora Queen. Thanks for listening in today. We've got a great show for you. Today we have Steve Wozniak. And although he really needs no introduction, he's the co-founder of Apple. Mike Ward got the chance to sit down with him when he came to the Microsoft campus in Redmond to speak about his book. It was the first time he ever visited the Microsoft campus, and the room was packed and overflowing with people that had so much respect for him. It was great to see. Here's Mike Ward and Steve Wozniak on TechNet Radio.
So I am here with Steve Wozniak. And first off, I have to point out that you're at Microsoft. So, and you had a huge turnout. And
I think
people were clamoring to get into there, and they ran out of room.
I was a little nervous, only because I realized it almost is like a big event. What if somebody like big up in Microsoft came to Apple to give a talk? Boy, everyone would want to hear it.
Do you think so?
Oh, God, I think so, yeah.
I think there's definitely, first off, for yourself, you're kind of, when I think of you, I think of obviously Steve Jobs, but I actually think of like Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer and all the players and Nolan Bushnell, the players in the industry at the time around the same era. But I'll think of you all going to dinner when you're Sunday night, you know, you kind of all meet up, but I suspect it's not quite that way.
I was always into devices and not that much into people and networking. So I'd probably be the one that would miss the dinner, make up some excuse.
That's very interesting, but it's the kind of the peers that were creating similar devices at the time, I guess, is probably why I grew you all together.
It was so amazing, too, well, especially in Silicon Valley, being around so many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So have you been to Microsoft previously?
Never.
You've never been to Microsoft?
Never.
That's astounding. I thought you would have been here numerous times in the past.
I don't hang around in the business end of the world, the financial ends of the world, the CEO ends of the world. I kind of hang around with technologists, and I run into a lot of people, you know, on the street. I don't even go to Apple that often.
Yeah.
So usually just to visit, you know, a technology friend, an engineer, you know, have lunch.
Sure. Yeah, and I suspect you would have had a lot here. So, well, I guess the first question is, you're here for your book. I mean, you've got a book out now, and I'm curious, why a book now?
You're right. First of all, I'm sort of the person that doesn't really want to go out and do things like books or things that get notoriety. I've been offered money in the past twice to do books. And you know what? I took it and then I returned the money and said, I don't have time. I got all these things going on in my life. This time it was sort of different. I met a girl at a concert. She called her friend on the phone. Do you know Steve Wozniak? Because she didn't know who I was. And her friend, Gina Smith, had been a technology reporter and everything, said, oh my God, I want to do his autobiography. So I met Gina and she said she wanted to do my autobiography. We hit it off and I said, okay. Well, once you have a partner in the process, you can't let them down.
Right.
So the book actually got finished and a long process, and it's out now. And if something I've done, I want to make it, you know, as excellent as possible.
I think it's getting good reviews because I went to pick up a copy of it, and there was only a couple copies left at Borders. And the woman who I asked where it was, she said it's been a real seller. So
I have heard from other people. I've read a couple, but I've heard it's getting very good reviews everywhere. And it's high up, number 21 in the New York Times bestseller list that somebody said was number one in the Harvard bookstore.
Wow. That's
amazing. I just did a little tour out in the East Coast and went to a lot of these, a lot of places. I never knew what a book tour was, but every day is a different city scheduled from morning till night, usually like 8 events.
And you kind of feel like you're answering the same questions a lot and saying
I'm actually so excited about those times I'm talking about. Yeah. I've been going good and strong. Yeah.
That's great. So let's dig into it.
Also, if you're going to give a talk or something, you never talk the same subjects the same day. You always change the speech. Yeah.
Right. Otherwise, you'd probably get pretty bored of it yourself, I suspect. So, you know, I read through your book. Very interesting. It's especially interesting to see like the early days of all this. So the first question I had is, I was wondering, I noticed like your background with your family and everything, and how much influence do you think Silicon Valley had on where you ended
up? Oh, total.
Up?
So huge an amount. I don't think any of what happened to me, to Apple, would have happened if I hadn't grown up in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
I was there from days when it was orchards being cut down and we built our ham radios out of tubes. I got to see transistors come, and my father working at Lockheed knew the companies, and they would donate transistors and diodes to me for science fair projects. When chips came, I couldn't ever afford them, but at least I was aware of them.
Right.
And I was going around, and my dad working at Lockheed knew all the chip makers that were making the chips that were going to make missiles lighter you know, every fraction of a gram counts. He would take me to tours in the chip making companies in the earliest days.
Yeah.
How lucky could you be?
Especially other kids don't even know those existed.
Yeah. Another advantage of growing up in Silicon Valley is so many engineers were moving in to work for Lockheed that a lot of the kids were around electronics and electronic parts, and we could build projects out of Popular Electronics magazine. And when all your peers are interested in something, that helps push you in that direction, keep you going in that direction.
Yeah.
So, yes.
You're even influenced at a young age. So the one thing I did have to point out, by the way, your early science fair projects, I don't think I could do those now.
So. I look back and I do not know how, as a young 10, 11 year old, 13 year old, I could have done such incredibly complicated projects that took so much time to build with so many parts. And I look back and I understood every little piece of it too.
Right.
I mean, the adder subtractor I built in eighth grade. I did electronics solutions where I had got rid of some resistors and replaced them with diodes, and I did a gate solution where I made an adder and a subtractor into one part by adding a few gates of my own, and
yep.
Just one thing after another. Yeah,
learned,
you know, I knew
stuff.
It all, the binary. But the projects that I did were luckily on that the right stepping path.
Yep.
From the ground zero, learning about how atoms work, right on up to the Apple II computer.
Right.
I just had the lucky transition that took me right straight the right path. Best course you could have to be a computer designer.
Yeah, you definitely built the foundation of knowledge. So on the Apple I, I was really curious when I read about the Apple I, you had said it, you know, you viewed it as a kind of a people's machine in a way. And what did you actually envision people using the machine for? I know later on VisiCalc came out and that became like a big part of its use, but what were you thinking people would take it home and do with it?
Well, with the Apple I, part of that was I wrote a computer language without any training.
Yep.
The best things I ever did at Apple were because I didn't have money and I didn't have training.
Yep.
Hadn't done them before. And the Apple I with BASIC, the BASIC was intended to do two main things. I didn't know that much about computers in companies. I know that they run companies, they do financial stuff, they run programs for people, but I don't know if I have enough computer to do that. I don't
right.
know what they do. I was so shy, way too shy to find out. But I know some things computers do. They play games, and they solved my engineering problems for designing calculator chips at Hewlett-Packard.
Right.
So that was the two things it was going to do. And then I had a computer that I knew I could program for life.
So in the Apple I almost would be something, though, in and of itself, it was an achievement, right? Even if it didn't have any huge implications. It's not like you create it thinking everybody's
it was actually a shortcut. It was not designing a computer from the ground up. It was already having parts of a computer, a keyboard that could type to a computer far away, and a TV set that could display characters and words from a computer far away, and just saying, hey, now I can build it all in one piece, and I have my own computer.
Right.
So it was a quick little job, but it sure changed the world. Every computer since the Apple I came with a keyboard.
Right.
A human keyboard that you could type on, and that had never been the case before.
Yeah, I think I'd have a hard time with punch cards right now. I wouldn't get much done, I don't think. So.
Right. Well, you had expensive teletypes that no one could afford, but I had a free home TV.
Yeah.
That helped. The keyboard for input, there was nothing else cheap.
Yeah.
So I was really doing it to save money and to save complexity in the computer design. Rather than have one of those big, ucky front panels with all these airplane cockpit-type switches that you'd have no idea what they do.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. So it looks like even a little before that was the blue box. I mean, you always played with technology, it looks like. You're a hacker in the old sense, right? You hacked to play and see what it would become of it.
And every time I played, I tried to do some really great design that would impress people, like nobody else would have done this good a design.
Yeah.
You did it in fewer parts. Whoa, I would have never thought of that. And actually in the Blue Box, some of the parts of the Blue Box design carried all the way up to the Apple II computer.
Really?
I mean, you learn techniques and then you keep doing them from then on.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
I found it kind of funny, actually, because I was looking at the Blue Box and I thought, it's interesting that you were effectively hacking the phone system. And then I thought, wasn't Kevin Mitnick involved? Wasn't that his big area?
Much later years. But Blue Box was only, I only did it 1 year of my life.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't. I didn't feel safe and I didn't make my calls for money.
Yeah.
The ones that I would pay to call my friends and relatives that were long distance, I still did that. I didn't want to use the Blue Box for that.
Right.
I just wanted to explore the system.
Okay.
Now, I wasn't a perfect person ethically because looking back, I sold them to other people who were just using them to make free calls to rip off the phone company.
Yeah.
So I wasn't, so even though I was kind of pure myself, I wasn't totally legal.
But it looks like from your stories, you ran into the dark side of that at one point when one was taken from you. So
at gunpoint, I look at that as an adventure in life. I look at that as a very positive thing to have happened.
Yeah, that's probably true. The funny thing is when I looked up Kevin Mitnick on the internet, and it looks like you were actually interviewed by Kevin Mitnick in the recent past. Is that right?
I'm trying to remember. Kevin's a good friend, and I see him a lot, and it's possible he interviewed me or read it or wrote something up as an interview.
Yeah, okay. It's funny to see all of these worlds intersect from the past to the present. You know, it's, you're part of a group of people that keeps intersecting.
Kevin's a great friend. As a matter of fact, once I went on Tech TV with him, and they had given me a GPS device that would track where my car drove in the morning.
Yeah.
So I drove around a path of streets in my town of Los Gatos that spelled out "Free Kevin" when I put it on the TV.
That's great. I don't even know if I could figure out how to drive the streets like that.
You could, but it's tough. It's tough. The streets aren't shaped the way the letters are.
Oh, yeah. Definitely wouldn't think so. So then I was noticing also the Atari in Nolan Bushnell, that whole world kind of ended up in an early part of your history there also. And you had mentioned when you built the Apple One even that games were a part of it. Did you ever think of just kind of going down the game path?
I never thought of going down the game path. I just wanted to build myself a Pong, and then later the opportunity to do a breakout in hardware design came up, and nope, I never once thought I'd divert and do games.
Yep. You just thought
no, I got to watch a lot of the development and improvement of game technology as far as how do you use software to get this many bits to move this fast.
Yeah.
I got to see a lot of that early development right on the Apple II. Matter of fact, we did a game in-house. A programmer named Dana Reddington did a game that we called Star Wars till the movie forced us to change the name to something else. But it was basically little planes flying overhead, and you could shoot them with missiles down below that you could aim the guns to point at them. And God, what that took as far as clever tricks to get the microprocessor to do very, very few instructions to get things done.
Right.
Some incredible programming I helped Dana out on. So I helped a little bit at that level of game. He had the first game ever, basically, that used high-res graphics on a computer and got that quality of play. And I was just disappointed. Steve Jobs sneered at him. I think fired him.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I thought he did a lousy job, and it was one of the most incredible technology jobs I'd been close to in my life.
Yeah. Do you think Steve was just looking at the business side of it, or was it...
I don't think Steve understood that there were nearly impossible tasks with a microprocessor running, you know, one cycle per microsecond. Impossible tasks that had been solved, and the game was good and popular.
Yeah.
Maybe Steve wanted more, I don't know.
What do you play any games yourself today, then?
Yes, I do. I'm the sort of person who doesn't play all the new young kid, the games that the kids get into for, you know, their whole lives they can put into them, or the ones that are very hard to play, intense. I play usually the simple puzzle type games that almost date to the old days. I play Tetris to this day. I was always in Nintendo Power magazine for Game Boy Tetris. They never printed any score higher than mine.
Really?
Yeah.
And I
also played Tetris on the side of a 14-story building. I like to play a couple of card games on the computer now and then. Like every day, hearts and spades.
Yep.
I loved Snood, but we went to a new computer based on Intel chips, and it won't play the version of Snood I like, so I won't play it.
So that was one of my questions, actually, is you must certainly use a Mac at home then.
Yes, I use a laptop, and that's my only and primary computer.
Is it?
And because I used to have like 30 computers around the house, computers here, computers there, computers anywhere you wanted.
Yeah.
And one time I called friends over to put all my CDs into computers, and we had 30 computers. I'd put 5 computers in front of each person and a set of CDs, and worked great. But now I really only have my laptop. I got one tower that stores my larger music collection, the one that's in pure form right off the CDs, AIFF form. Because, you know, we have MP3s, and it takes 30 hours to convert my library to MP3s.
Yeah.
Then Apple comes out with MP4s. Crap. So I had to, so what I did was, instead of re-importing all the CDs as MP4s, I read them all in as pure AIFF files, and I told the computer to take 30 hours and convert them to MP4s. And if they ever go to MP5s, I'll get there in 30 hours.
You just solved one of my problems, actually. So I was trying to figure out what to do with all my CDs, and I think that's a great way to solve that problem.
Actually, don't store it in AIFF. Use a lossless format that keeps the data exactly as it was on the CD, but takes about half the space.
Now, that's a great idea, actually. So I want just to go back a little bit, and I'd love to actually get your views on the present on some things, but I'm curious... One of the things that, you know, in the whole Microsoft Apple world was Microsoft licensed their operating system, and people probably ask you this all the time. But did it ever come up when you were there about licensing?
Well, we started Apple. I mean, for some time up till we went public, we were larger than Microsoft. And then all of a sudden, Microsoft with its software and all of the PCs are taking us over in sales, because you'd walk in a store, you see PC, 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 and it feels a little more comfortable, a little safer than the one Macintosh. I think that was one of the problems we had. We didn't license, and although I felt I was for licensing because I believed in open computers like the Apple II.
Yeah.
Boy, our management and our executives at Apple, every one of them, every single one, was down on it as just a way of giving away more than we get, keep control of. But whether it was good or bad, what was the question?
Well, if it ever even came up, and I guess you answered that, it did come up apparently at the time, and
well,
you
no.
were in favor.
Well, yeah, Microsoft was a software company. It became so huge, and I thought, God, you know, we could just, you know, software is really what defines a computer nowadays.
Yeah.
Our jam is not we're making better hardware. We don't have a better serial port. We have a different serial port.
Right.
So why don't we, what if we just licensed our software? Our software has the amount of profit we're making, that's in the software. Let's say it's $1 billion a year. If we license the software out to other companies to make the hardware, but use our software, we'd still make the same $1 billion profit that we do by making the hardware. But we wouldn't have to build all these big factories and take the risk of shutting them down and all this other stuff. But we'd be lower on the Fortune 500 measurement system.
Because instead of
selling a computer for 10 times as much, we'd be licensing the operating system for 1 times as much. So we would be much lower on the Fortune 500 list.
So even as a hardware person, though, because your background is mostly in hardware, and from what I took from the book, you're very much a hardware person. You got electrocuted a lot when you were trying hardware in the early days. You still felt that licensing the operating system might have been a good choice at the time, even. Because you would have been fairly immersed in hardware at that point, right?
No, I expressed that view to some people at the time quietly. I'm a very quiet talker, and it's not right for me to go back at this stage and say, yeah, I think it would have. I think even Steve Jobs wonders if maybe we made the wrong decision. In theory, you're supposed to define an operating system and software in such a way that the operating system insulates many different types of hardware, many different manufacturers, different implementations, all wind up in the same, working under the same operating system, so they get coerced to the same set of rules, a good enough set of rules that they will work with the software all properly.
Yeah.
That's the job of an operating system. So theoretically, we could have kept things workable. We didn't need to make the hardware and the software to have the best experience of all. I don't really believe that.
Yeah. Well, who knows? And I wouldn't mean to say that things would be different today.
But on the other hand, who's ever achieved what I said is software operating systems are all about?
Yeah.
Who's ever made an operating system that one version later, the same hardware still works?
Right.
You know, no.
I think most of us learned the lesson a long time ago. Yeah, when you upgrade the operating system, take the hardware upgrade with it.
And yet it was supposed to be that, yeah, the operating system could just be done and improved and upgraded and improved, and all the peripherals still interface to the same way. They still worked. Nah.
It never really ended up the case, I guess. Just to touch on some present-day stuff, because I think you have great views of things. Well, first off, I'm just curious, do you ever just stop and look at something like an iPod and say the technology that's in that in comparison to what you were doing in the early days must just be kind of astounding? I mean, I think most people take it for granted of what's actually happening in such a deceivingly simple device, right?
I don't look at that. And the technology, even in the Apple II computer I designed, was actually pretty sophisticated compared to an iPod.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In what sense? In the sense that you had to assemble
the
it
number,
all?
The number of user functions and the number of steps I had to take to design it, the little tidbits and aspects of it.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to pin down, but an iPod, you could almost define every menu of an iPod in a very small space.
Sure.
The Apple II computer, boy, it had the hardware schematic. The iPod really by then just had a standard microprocessor connected to a chip that will drive an LCD display. You could look over the circuit and figure it out much easier.
Pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Well, I know when you mentioned when you designed both the Apple I and the Apple II, if I'm correct, you had done most of the work yourself, if not entirely yourself.
Entirely myself. Actually, my friend Alan Baum did a good contribution to the Apple II, writing some debugging code. He wrote it, and then I just improved it to my level of quality for things like a little disassembler that if you told it a place in memory to go, it would kind of disassemble it into something that looked like computer instructions
okay.
that it thought were there. And he did, and that kind of a project, that debugging aid, owe him a lot for. I think it really helped people understand our Apple II and be able to use it.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Now, in today's day and age, then, do you think it would be possible to do something like that, or is it a similar environment in the sense that you can still take pieces and make something different, or do you think it's just out of the realm of one person now? And do you do any hacking?
I don't
of your
know. For a computer, it's very difficult ever in history, because before me, the computers were so huge, they took large teams of people working on the different aspects of it.
Yeah.
One person, myself, I did power supplies, not the final power supply for the Apple II, though. I did the drafting, I did the technician work, I did the design, I did the engineering, I did the testing, did the redoing, I did the hardware along with the software. Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
When you do it like that, yeah, it's always very pure.
And you think it'd be today would be possible then still?
Not for something major that changes the world.
Yeah.
But then again, how can you know what you don't know?
That's very true. That's always the hard part, isn't it? So do you do any sort of hacking yourself still? Do you try and assemble things at home? And
no, seldom, because of my time. That bans on my time.
Yeah.
But what I did recently was I put together a Segway key burner. The Segway key has a chip in it that tells the Segway how fast to go, among other things.
Yep.
So I built my own little burner that I can burn in my own codes.
Okay.
like faster speeds than they give you.
Yeah, that's great.
I know. It's a fun little device.
So you can't stop yourself from being a hacker still at this point. You
I don't get the time to do it as much as I want to.
Yeah.
If I had totally nothing to do in the world, I would just instantly start getting some chips in my possession, soldering irons, and dream up a couple little projects with a microprocessor embedded and start making things just on my own, just for fun. That's exactly what I would love to do in life.
That's great.
And I can't.
So a lot of your background, you had always aspired to be an engineer when you were young, and you became an engineer, obviously. And I'm curious then, being a teacher also, what you think of the current environment. I know we're kind of losing a lot of our engineering base. For instance, I was at a graduation for my brother-in-law, and the number of engineers father-in-law was commenting, the number of engineers was reversed in percentages. It used to, when he graduated, it was mostly engineers, and now it's mostly not engineers. Do you think it's something that's just people need to be influenced when they're younger, or?
Well, it's, again, you can't know what you don't know. If there are products that would really change your life and improve it, but they aren't here yet, we don't know what they are.
Yeah.
And the number of people that are trying and capable of putting together devices that are capable of finding one or two that just catches on and we all thank our lucky stars for, could be happening. I don't know. The more people you have that are engineers locally, the better.
Yep. Do you find when you were teaching, did you try and inspire that into your students, to the engineering side of things and the creation?
Yes, I did extremely. The most important thing to me in my classes was that how do you teach kids but retain a high level of creativity? You've got to build in a lot of fun. You've got to teach them that if they have some ideas, they can sometimes achieve them. They don't have limits as to what they want to do. Every student can think a little bit differently, and you have discussions with them.
Yep.
It takes a lot more time and effort than the normal classroom, but yeah.
That's great. So I know I heard you on NPR, and somebody had called in and asked you about the future questions, and you noted that you don't really like to predict the future too much.
No, I don't.
But I'm curious then, just more on what you think of what our challenges are looking out from here, more from the industry perspective. And are our challenges in educating people, or is it the complexity? I know particularly if you work in IT, it's such a complex environment now.
Even education would be so complex if we ever made a computer program that's really like a human being.
Yeah.
The aspects of artificial intelligence that would need to really understand a kid and what he wants to know, and if he's really short in some subject area. We don't do that.
So you think focusing even back on the kids? So if you were in high school now, what would you see as the
opportunity? If I was in high school now?
Yeah.
Well, I'd go into engineering was in me. Engineering design, maybe a different type of engineering, maybe aeronautical, maybe civil engineering. There's still places for engineers, yeah.
Yeah.
Things that you could calculate and use slide rules and calculate numbers, yeah.
That's great.
As far as electronics, I believe I'd still be going into electronics.
Yeah. That's great. That's great to hear. Well, I know we're almost out of time. Yep. So the one last thing I wanted to touch on was your pranks. So I heard a great closing from when you were speaking about your current prank. So what is the current prank?
Oh, no, I have lots of current pranks. I do them all the time.
I heard a good one about airplanes.
Well, yes, I have a little sticker that I put in airplane bathrooms, And I put it in a hidden way so you don't notice it unless you put the toilet seat down, but some people will see it. And it's just an official looking sign done the OSHA style, the OSHA colors.
Yeah.
And it says basically, danger, do not flush over cities. And it's done to a quality level that's higher than you can print on a personal computer. So
that's great.
So it looks more real.
No, of course you must enjoy it. More understanding that's happening because you can't watch people react to it.
That's true. Some pranks in your life you can, some you can't. This one you don't get to see the result.
Yep.
Someday I might be sitting somewhere and I might tell the story and somebody will say, I saw one of those and was totally shocked.
Yeah, that's great.
That'll be worth it.
That's one of the better pranks I've heard. Well, thanks a lot for your time. Definitely,
thank you.
We have to encourage people to read the book. You have an amazing background.
Steve Wozniak speaking with Mike Ward on TechNet Radio. If you want to check out Steve's website, the address for that is woz.org. That's W-O-Z.org. And I also put a link to his book up on our site, Microsoft.com/TN Radio, if you want to check that out. Remember, our email address here is tnradio@microsoft.com. And we always love to get feedback from you, so go ahead and drop us a line. Let us know what you think of this podcast. Thanks as always for tuning in. I look forward to next week. For TechNet Radio, I'm Aurora Queen.
Have comments or want to request a story idea? Call us at 1-877-814-6506.